This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden released his fiscal 2025 budget in Washington on Monday. What does the document tell us about the president's priorities and what he might do if he wins a second term? Plus, a bill to force a divestment of the social media app TikTok from its Chinese ownership is moving quickly through the House. Welcome to Potomac Watch. My name's Kate Batchelder Odell, and I'm here today with my talented colleagues, columnist and editorial board member Alicia Finley, as well as editorial board member Mine Ukweberua. Thanks both for being here. Let's dive right in. The president puts out a budget every year, and on Monday, he came out with his fiscal 25 request, about $7.3 trillion total. This is an important day for policy wonks, a high day on our liturgical calendar, if you will. But I'll make the case here that this is an important document for understanding what President Biden thinks about what his priorities should be for the rest of his administration and what he might do if he were to win a second term. So, Alicia, let's walk through your top line impressions of looking at this budget document. I mean, my initial takeaway is that there are some ferocious tax increases in this document, many of which don't have a good chance of becoming law anytime soon. Why don't you walk us through what President Biden's tax system really looks like if he were to have his way?
Under his budget, you'd see trillions of dollars, about, I think, $3 trillion in higher taxes over the next decade, and which actually, if you think about it in the big scheme of things, isn't that big, considering that the debt is expected to grow by a little over $20 trillion over the next decade. But what you see in his budget is a lot of the things that he teed up during his State of the Union, which is increasing the corporate tax rate to 28% from 21%, an increase in the alternative minimum tax, and this is separate from the actual alternative minimum tax. This is on just book income. So that's the kind of income that corporations report on their financial statements, which excludes a lot of various deductions. And right now that's at 15%. And that was actually a new addition in the Inflation Reduction Act. Now Biden is proposing to increase that minimum tax to 21%. He's also proposing, if you recall, the editorial pages have written a lot on this new global tax agreement in the OECD, which would set a tax floor of 15%. Biden has been lobbying Congress to impose it, saying, well, if we don't, American companies are just going to get taxed more by these other countries, and so we should impose it nonetheless so we can get our fair share of the revenues. Well, it's interesting. Now Biden is kind of actually proposing to break the whole tax agreement by suggesting raising the rate to 21% instead of 15%. And I don't even think you could get a lot of the European countries to go along with that, the ones that actually pushed for the OECD agreement. There's also an increase. He wants to increase the top marginal rate to 39.6% from 37%. That will actually automatically go up with the expiration of the 2017 tax reforms. But in addition, he wants to apply that 39.6% rate to capital gains for people earning over $400,000. And that would be up from about 20% right now. So that's just a massive increase. Plus, he plans to layer on an additional 5% Medicare tax on that. So you could actually see the top federal rate increasing to around 45%, layer on state and local taxes in places like California and New York, and you're nearly at 60%. And so those are just the highlights of the taxes. There are various other small things that he proposes to do, like eliminating numerous deductions for oil and gas companies now take advantage of, you know, capping or eliminating actually the deduction for corporate executives. And that actually just doesn't raise that much revenue. And I think that's really the big picture of all this, is that you take a step back, even with all these tax proposals that Biden has put on the table, and these would be the biggest tax increases in history. Your budget still only projects that revenue will rise to about 20.3% of GDP. It's only gotten to 20% one time in all of history. And the average over the last 50 or so years has been 17.3%. All these tax increases really aren't going to make a dent in the deficit. What they'll do is just depress economic growth.
I think that's a really good point on the share of the economy and revenues. I mean, tax receipts are very healthy, on track to fit 18.7% of the economy in 2025. And the average since 1974 was 17.3%. So I think what that really underscores, to your point, is that we don't have a tax receipt problem. We have a spending problem. Because if you look at these budget projections, I mean, we're talking about going to spending that reaches a quarter of national wealth. You know, Mitch McConnell was on the floor Tuesday talking about this and said, we're talking about tax and spending levels that approach World War II, but we are not going to be spending any of that on national defense. And I thought it might raise that subject here in our conversation, because what's so striking in this budget release is that you have any number of spending priorities. Some that just come to mind are, you have President Biden wants to expand child tax credit back to a large $3,000 for older children, fully refundable, meaning you get it as a payment. This is a huge entitlement. He proposed, again, subsidized childcare with subsidies going to anybody earning up to $200,000, which is a large amount of money in parts of this country. Also, a new paid family leave entitlement. These are enormous spending programs. But the one thing that President Biden is not interested in spending on is our national defense. The Defense Department in this budget is at $850 billion, and it's about 1% over the department's budget in 2024. So it's the fourth time in a row that Biden has proposed a real cut to defense after inflation. And if you think about what's happened since the 2024 budget request, that includes October 7th in Israel. We've had Iranian proxies that are firing drones and rockets at U.S. troops in the Middle East. You have terrorists in Yemen that are taking a global shipping lane hostage. You have ferocious increases in defense spending by the Chinese. So it's just an incredibly odd dichotomy here to have this budget document that is so divorced from the reality of the world, but also seems as though it could continue spending on any other priority. One thing we haven't talked about yet is Social Security, which President Biden made a point about. Let's take a listen to what he had to say about his own Social Security priorities and his budget.
Folks, we have two ways to go at Social Security and Medicare. Republicans will cut Social Security and Medicare to give us more tax cuts for the wealthy. Even this morning, Donald Trump said cuts to Social Security and Medicare are on the table again. But the bottom line is, he's still at it. I'm never going to allow that to happen. I won't cut Social Security. I won't cut Medicare. Instead of cutting Medicare and Medicaid and give tax breaks to the wealthy, I will protect and strengthen Social Security and Medicare and make the wealthy begin to pay their fair share.
Manet, what's your reaction to this pure demagoguery on Social Security? Do you know of any Republicans who have the mettle to reform Social Security anymore? What do you make of the president's remarks?
Within the past decade, we've gone from a Republican Party where there were active proposals being put on the table by Paul Ryan and others for how to rationalize the system, because on the current pace, we're going to have automatic mandatory cuts across the board by about 2032. And so the system needs to be reformed if it's going to remain solvent. And yet we have seen that issue play out electorally as an extremely difficult one to touch, even with very rational reforms that ask for small changes like increasing the retirement age slightly, making those changes only for people who are currently very young and have paid very little in payroll taxes thus far, and other little changes that are designed to make the system just a little bit more sustainable. And yet Republicans get pilloried whenever they were releasing proposals of this kind. And so generally they've backed off the issue. And Donald Trump's candidacy really cemented that change. You see very few Republicans who are willing to go anywhere near the issue. And yet Democrats know that it's a big winner for them, and that in the minds of some voters, they're very willing to believe, despite the lack of evidence, that there are looming plans for dramatic immediate cuts to Social Security and other entitlements. And so you're going to continue to see President Biden make that case in his budget and elsewhere that reelecting him is the only bulwark against immediate entitlement cuts. That would be very deep. The irony is that these are conversations that both parties ought to be having, but the political climate makes it almost impossible to do that. And so I think anyone viewing the Biden budget should take his statements on that issue with a grain of salt and know that it's just playing playing politics. But what we do need is an opportunity for Republicans to actually begin to have conversations about what the most feasible plans would look like and to demonstrate some of the courage to actually talk about entitlement reform in a way that's going to re-enter it into the public conversation and put us on pace to actually get some kind of compromise.
Hang tight. We'll be back with more Potomac Watch in a moment.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
We're back with Potomac Watch. I'm Kate Batchelder Odell, and I'm here with my colleagues, Alicia and Manet. And we're talking about the federal budget and Biden's proposal. So, Alicia, some one striking chart you sent me from the Biden budget request is really looking at just how large some of our entitlement priorities have gotten. And I'm thinking in particular of a chart that shows that federal aid to state and local governments, which includes entitlement aid like Medicaid, outstrips our spending on national defense. I mean, this is a really startling point. And we've been talking on this show with some regularity that net interest on the federal debt is also set to outstrip our defense spending. What does this tell you about the country's ability to reorganize its fiscal priorities? And do you see any shot at getting after the real driver of the problem, as Manet is pointing out, is Social Security?
Right. So entitlements in broadly defined, and these are programs that essentially run on autopilot. They don't need discretionary. They don't need congressional appropriations every year. Those constitute about two-thirds of the budget. In terms of the state and local governments, the problem is that they've been really dependent, or they've become increasingly reliant on the federal government for money. And essentially what the federal government does is borrow more and more. And by the way, states have balanced budget amendments, so they can't actually do what the federal government does, which is essentially borrow to pay their bills. But what states do is essentially they just get increasing amount of allocations from their federal government. So that right now, federal government grants to state and local governments is about $1.1 trillion, which is about $250 billion more than federal defense spending. Now, a lot of that is Medicaid, about a third of that is Medicaid, but there's still a lot for public transit, K through 12 education. You have the big bucket of what is called income security programs, and these can include essentially grant programs or free school lunches, money that gets distributed to the states to allocate to their populations. And this has been growing actually much faster than many other areas of the budget, all these combined in inflation-adjusted terms, actually. The aid to the states has increased by 12.5% since 2020, which is, again, striking because 2020, that wasn't exactly a low year. That was during the first year of the pandemic and when aid to the states actually increased tremendously. If you go back to 2015, and this is again in inflation adjusted terms, aid to the states has increased by 40%. If you've been looking at the job numbers lately, over half of the increase has been from social assistance, healthcare, and state and local government. And a lot of that is because the federal largesse is continuing to flow to the states. And one problem the states are having, though, is that their labor costs and their spending is increasing faster than the actual distributions and their tax revenue. Now, that's a separate issue. But going back to the federal fisc, the problem isn't just that more and more people are dependent on welfare. It's the fact that more and more governments, I think, are too, as well as these kind of nonprofit entities that distribute federal funds, which makes it all the harder to actually roll back some of these programs. You have states like Wyoming, Montana, and everyone wants their share of the lard. So there's a large constituency for more entitlement spending.
Manet, I want to give you a quick last word here before we move on. We know that a lot of this is fantasy land and it's not going to become law, but there is a live debate on Capitol Hill about expiring tax provisions from the 2017 Trump tax cuts, for instance. What do you see in this budget that might become a live part of a larger negotiation? How is it being received on Capitol Hill?
So we are going to see the expiration of the income tax cuts that Republicans managed to enact in 2017 under President Trump. President Biden has come out early and said that he wants to preserve those cuts for everyone who earns less than $400,000. So that would mean all but that top income tax rate, which would go up from 37% to 39.7% after the expiration, he wants to preserve. But I think everyone on Capitol Hill knows that that's going to come with a price. He's not going to push Democrats to go ahead and preserve those tax cuts simply as they are, but he's going to want to get a leverage from, you know, rather preserving those lower tax rates is going to be used as leverage to pull Republicans into joining on some kind of extension of other Democratic tax priorities. And so the child tax credit, which you mentioned already, probably is one of the bigger provisions that they'll hope to fold into some kind of broader tax deal at that point. And we've already seen Republicans start to embrace the child tax credit in the current Congress. It has been included in a deal that would extend some business tax cuts that were passed in the 27 tax bill with a larger and extended child tax credit. It doesn't currently seem like it has enough support to pass in the Senate among a lot of obstinate Republicans. But I do think that as you get closer to the possibility of those individual tax rates rising, you're going to see Democrats making the case that that is a provision that could be included in a larger deal. And so voters who are looking at what is the substance in Biden's tax priorities that they can parse from this budget should look at that as one of the main provisions and understand that there are going to be pending negotiations using individual income tax rates as leverage to try to turn some of these fantasy tax policies into realities.
We'll take one more break. And when we get back, we'll talk about whether that fun dance app on your phone is a threat to national security.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back to Potomac Watch. Chatting now about a bill moving through the House of Representatives this week that would essentially force a divestment of TikTok, the social media app, from its Chinese owners. The bill passed through the relevant House committee by an overwhelming margin and looks likely to pass the House. Alicia, you've been following this story a long time because there have been efforts to force a breakup of TikTok from its owner, ByteDance, for years now, but Trump's effort, for instance, couldn't hold up in court. What do you make of this latest effort, both on the merits on how much of a threat is TikTok to our national security? And is this effort, do you think, more worthy and more likely to succeed than past attempts?
Well, on the first question, I think is without doubt that TikTok presents a real and clear threat to Americans. And many who use TikTok, primarily the younger generation, just are completely oblivious to it. I saw some surveys show that younger Americans use the app for almost 6 hours every day. It's mind-boggling. And the threat isn't just that they're consuming these silly videos or some that are actually more dangerous and send them down rabbit holes on eating disorders or self-harm and can cause suicides. All of that's been documented. I think the bigger danger is that this app is collecting all sorts of data, location data, browsing data, search data about the users and their friends. And it's not just using this data for political targeting. We don't know to the extent that what it is doing with this data. We know that it's going back to China, where the ByteDance, which is TikTok's corporate parent, is using the data to train its algorithms, but we don't know exactly what else it's doing with this data. And we know that the Chinese government, the CCP, has a very extensive surveillance operation and cyber espionage operation that's been trying to infiltrate U.S. systems through various means. The Office of personnel. A lot of federal workers last decade had their emails and their personal information hacked by China. And so they're basically building this massive repertoire of information on Americans that they can use in various ways. And again, that's a danger. But the other danger is that they're also trying to create this kind of political influence operation. And we saw and we heard about how the Russians tried to kind of use social media operations in 2016, especially in order to sow discord. They kind of promoted Bernie Sanders. They promoted Donald Trump. They basically just tried to wreak havoc in American politics and turn people against each other. And then to some extent, they were successful, though there are obviously a lot of other influences. We don't know what the Chinese are doing. I think the Chinese, we have information that they are actively censoring. ByteDance has censored or suppressed information that is kind of particularly sensitive to the CCP. I mean, Tiananmen Square massacre, the Hong Kong protests, the information about Tibet. But we don't also know to what extent it's amplifying kind of divisive topics. I mean, again, there was a study by the Network for Contagion Research Institute that kind of looked at the disparity between hashtags on Instagram and TikTok and found a lot of the hashtags that were more divisive in American politics, like pro-Hamas, occurred like 20 times more, fold more on TikTok than it did on Instagram. And the question is, well, why is that? It's probably because the algorithms are amplifying it. Last fall, Osama bin Laden's 2002 letter to America, which was just full of anti-Semitic tropes and basically conspiracy theories about the U.S., such as it created HIV, went viral on TikTok. And these videos racked up nearly 15 million of views. And eventually, when it drew an uproar and started to, you know, draw attention from Congress, TikTok took it down, though it said that, well, nothing in our algorithm. We didn't do anything for this video to go viral. And I think members of Congress are growing increasingly skeptical of the company's denials. It's starting to come off as a little bit of gaslighting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to reduce the risks to, one, espionage and data collection, and two, that broader point about influence. You don't have to think hard to come up to an example where this could be a real problem in our politics. One that is always given to me is, imagine there is a crisis in the Taiwan Strait and that the Chinese Communist Party has decided to take military action there, as we have been worried about for a long time. And there was an ability for the CCP to kind of promote certain messages about what was going on there and have a profound influence on what Americans think about that issue, would maybe try to tell them to shut down efforts in Congress for the U.S. to intervene and what's going on in the Pacific. I mean, so there are some real scenarios about how that influence might be used that should give everyone some pause, I think. Minae, a lot of folks who are against the TikTok divestment bill, it has some strange political bedfellows. I mean, there are Republicans who are against it. Trump has suggested he's against it, though his views are a little bit murky. You have Rand Paul in the Senate who is against it. And one argument that's being made is that it's a First Amendment issue. It's a matter of free expression. I don't think that holds a lot of water, given we're talking about the problem being the owner of the platform, not the messages that Americans are putting out or their freedom to do so. But I'm curious what you make of those First Amendment claims and whether you think they would have any standing in court, since inevitably this is heading to litigation if it passes.
I do think that looking at TikTok and the possibility of banning it on the surface, there are First Amendment questions that automatically jump to mind, but I also agree with you that the authors of the bill took those into account. The most relevant precedent that a lot of the critics have pointed to is Lamont versus Postmaster General from 1965, which was a case involving the ability of communist organizations from overseas to distribute their materials through U.S. mail to American citizens. Congress tried to regulate that, and then the Supreme Court found that there is a right to receive information from foreign adversaries, even outright false or propagandistic information. And so there are First Amendment protections for the dissemination of materials, even from foreign adversaries. And I think most Americans who are free speech minded would agree that the government shouldn't be in the business of outright regulating the dissemination of the information itself. But as you mentioned, the bill is targeted towards TikTok as the parent company and its ownership of the broadcast medium. So the idea is not necessarily that you are going to curb directly the types of messages that are allowed to be broadcast over TikTok, But the idea is that that might take place if the ownership were to change hands to a U.S.-based separate entity, or if it were to be sold, then we wouldn't have the Chinese Communist Party being able to directly influence that distribution of propaganda through the medium. And so it's a distinction in terms of what is the corporate structure rather than directly banning the content itself. But I do think that the Senate is currently trying to tighten up some of that language. Hopefully, they'll be able to do it in a way that doesn't gut or weaken what the bill is aiming to do. I'm worried about the potential that a lawsuit would be able to unwind it. And so hopefully there are some critics who outright don't want to do it, and they probably are unpersuadable. But I think that there are a lot of people, particularly in the Senate, who are on the fence and have some legitimate concerns who they want to see addressed in an updated version of the bill. And hopefully they're able to reach a compromise that would still allow the substantive aims of the bill to be addressed.
Well, Manet, we'll let you have the last word, but we'll be watching closely to see how this TikTok bill plays out. Thank you both for joining me, and we'll be here tomorrow again with more Potomac Watch.